Call this meeting of the House Resources to order, or House Resources Committee to order. It is 1:47 p.m. on Monday, March 13th. Members present are Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Delana Johnson, Vice Chair Dean Westlake, Representative Dean Westlake, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and Summers Cole is our LAO moderator. Thank you all for your help with our work today. Before we get started, if we could please ask members and members of the audience to silence their cell phones, that would be great. This is a little bit unusual, so we have to be somewhat flexible with how our day is going to go. The plan, we had three bills scheduled for today, and given what's going to take place on the floor and the need to go back for floor session at some time and then the delay in our start, we may not get to all of those, and if that's the case, then we'll likely recess this meeting so we can come back at another time in between the 100 or 200, I don't know, I don't have a good count on how many amendments were going to be considered on the floor. So appreciate members' flexibility with that and an understanding that we're just going to do the best we can working within that schedule. So we're going to start with House Bill 111 today. On Friday, we went over the changes that are in the N version of the bill. However, we had some technical difficulties that made it a little bit challenging to get through that. So there's just a couple things that we want to cover before we go into the couple of amendments that Representative Rauscher has authored. One of them is the handout that was just passed out to us. And one of the things we didn't get to talk a lot about was sort of how we approach the concept of uplift in this bill and why we chose to approach it in the way that we did. If you remember, Rich talked about this being an opportunity that you could use to, since we were considering doing away with cash credits and we were going to go to deductions, that this concept of an uplift was something that could be used to sort of level the playing field for the non-producers, because what currently happens is the producers use their losses generally in the year in which they're earned because they have a tax liability, and so they're able to have 100% of their losses used against their tax liability. However, for the non-producers, and we have used that 7-year average for start to, you know, first production, they will just be accumulating losses. And so how do we sort of accommodate that and offer something that's attractive? What you have in front of you on this handout we've handed out is just a comparison of the two different opportunities. And so you'll see with a 50% carry forward with the 8% interest, you know, by year 7, those individuals have recovered, you know, basically 85% of the cost. So it's not 100%. But the reason we want to bring this up is that we have to keep in mind that what we also offer is the GVR provision. And so these individuals who are not in production after year 7, not only will they get to carry forward all of those losses, but then starting in year 1 from when they become producers, they also have the GVR provision. And if we are too generous, what we've learned is we will erode all of the value. And so if we allow 100% of the losses to go forward with the 10% interest, for example, when you get to year 7, you're basically giving 200% of the value. 200% of the value plus the GVR provisions plus the other per barrel credit, it erodes all of the value away. So we can't go for 100%, because in the end, and if you'll remember, and it was back in one of Rich's presentations, what he actually recommended, and we didn't go this far in his presentation, was that we would do the bracketed tax based on profit, and then we would eliminate the per barrel credit as well as the GVR provisions. We have not eliminated the per barrel credit or the GVR provisions, although we've made modest modifications on the per barrel credit. And so, you know, one of the things we have to be careful about is just remembering how all of these sort of stack up against each other. And so that is why we felt like this is appropriate way to apply this uplift, because we're not at the same time doing away with the GVR provisions that apply once they become a producer. The other reason is that if you remember back to the another sort of item just to cover in terms of the changes we made to the per barrel credit, if you remember back from Ken's presentation, and he had a slide that showed the effective tax rate, and we talk about the tax rate being 35%, but what was shown, and this is slide 24 of that original presentation by him, if you have it there, is that really our effective tax rate is much lower than that. And what we did in the bill, recognizing that at the prices below $50, the 4% tax with the hard floor would be the way for the state to ensure that there's some value. So we left that at the 4%, but above $50, then we shifted it to the 5%. And what that allows is for there to be some value to the state when we're in the price ranges of about $50 to $70. And for example, if you just, and I'm just going to talk it through momentarily here, if you think about production being about 500,000 barrels per day and you back out a 12.5% royalty share, you have about 437,000 barrels times 365 days, so 160 million barrels produced annually. And if you look at the difference between the minimum tax, say, at $55 being, or even going higher, really, because the minimum tax is just where these provisions kick in. But if you look, the minimum tax at 4% would have been $1.80 per barrel, just $1.80. That's all the state of Alaska would get, because when you take the $55 price and you subtract $10 of transportation, you have a $45 GVPP. The lease expenditures are about $30.88. Your production tax value is $14.12. But then we take the 35% of that. So we already lose two-thirds of the value when we apply the 35% tax. So that leaves $4.94. When you subtract the very generous per barrel credit from that, which is $8 and remains $8 in the new bill, you'll see you're operating in completely in a minimum tax zone. So if we don't change the minimum tax, you know, our tax is around 9 to 13%. That's how low it is. That is, from our view, too low. We have to retain some of the value in the mid-price range because that's the new normal that we're going to operate in. By raising it to 5%, when you do the math, it's maybe about $70 million under certain circumstances. When you look at that production tax, the 5% as a percent of production tax value, it shifts, you know, at the lowest from 9% just to 11%. And where we are today, it shifts from about 13% to 16%. So very, very modest changes. The minimum tax, the $5 provision, 5% provision really works when we're at about $65, and then it's not really until the $75 price range where we change the per barrel credit that brings in a little bit more. But again, always keeping the effective tax rate, you know, in the 10 to 15%. If you remember from what our consultant said, as well as others, one of the ways that we can be a little more generous on the low side is if we take a little bit more on the high side. And the problem with the existing law right now, the way the per barrel is applied, there is a credit available when oil is $160 a barrel. We've never seen $160 a barrel oil, never in the history of oil prices. The top price we saw was $147. So we can't count on a windfall coming at a price that's never happened in the history of oil prices. So we shift that down just a little bit. So now the windfall price is more around $120 a barrel, so that if the state could get some windfall between 120 and maybe 145 or 50, which would be the top of what we've ever seen, you know, that's the area where we'd make a little bit more, so we can back off and make a little bit less in the low prices. So if we had more time, I would go through all of my sheets of modeling that I've done to really understand this. And I would say, as policymakers, you know, some of this is really pretty simple math, and we should not be relying on the Department of Revenue to run the numbers for us, because we're just talking about, you know, some simple equations here of subtracting things and then, you know, multiplying by percentages. And this is stuff I believe, you know, all of us are really capable of accomplishing. And I think, you know, when you really spend a lot of time looking at the numbers, what we've done is very modest and very responsive to some of the concerns we heard from industry. And And so that's what brings us here. So those were just a couple of the points that I wanted to talk through a little bit more on the math. I'm happy to share any of these items with you. And what I'll assure you is that what I also did was run four different price scenarios for four different dollar amount scenarios for the lease expenditures, because as the prices go up, what we should expect is that the lease expenditures will increase, because that's when they'll do additional work and hire people back on. We've seen contraction in that right now because people have been laid off. So for example, you know, in 2015, and we were looking at an average of 53, 54 barrel for lease expenditures plus transportation, but in 2016 that had dropped to $41.12. What's also helpful about looking at the math, and if anybody again wants to do this after the committee because we won't have time, is really understanding announcements like Smith Bay, for example. And when you run the math on it, you can see very clearly that a development like that is not going to take place until a substantially higher price per barrel is the norm, because the cost of doing that would make no sense. So, you know, understanding sort of what price environment you're operating in and what your expected lease expenditures look like, in addition to how the, you know, per barrel credit is applied, because remember, the per barrel credit is applied after you've already reduced your production tax value by a third. That per barrel credit has a lot of power because of the place it comes in that equation. So there's many things that we did not deal with, and I think, you know, again, we've made some very modest adjustments that reflect more this moderate to low price environment we're in. So a couple of other just quick comments on that is, you know, also when you think about what we've done with allowing these deductions to be carried forward, one of the things that the state does is allows the entire percentage to be carried forward. What might be typical, what you might also see when you talk about capital expenditures, is some form of depreciation, because that same, you know, and this is what's litigated through the value of TAPS, for example, that same piece of infrastructure is not worth the same, you know, today that is 2 or 3 or 4 years later. But when we carry forward their losses, we allow 100% of that value to go forward. We don't apply any depreciation. So there's a lot of generosity built into this, and feel very confident that these modest adjustments are the right move for the state at this time. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was just trying to wrap my head around the word generosity. I guess in light of the fine that was announced last week, the Armstrong Repsol discovery, or the announcement anyway, how do you see this new tax bill? Do you feel like that the previous regime was working? I mean, do you feel like that's a, you know, a positive that came out of that, or do you feel like did that change your view on this at all?
Representative Johnson, I really appreciate that question, and that's one of the things that prompted me to want to have this conversation about how much of the loss we're allowing to carry forward and how much of the value would be recovered. Because remember, this is for 7 years of development, but the GVR provisions are 7 years of production. So we're giving the first 14 years of work these very attractive opportunities. And, you know, if we're more generous with that, you know, it has the potential to make those announcements not much of excitement for the state. I mean, that's the real problem in that, with, you know, when you allow this to be more generous, which is why Rich, for example, suggested, you know, you could do the 100% carry forward losses and change to the bracket, but you'd also get rid of the GVR and the per barrel credit. And without getting rid of those two things, we're in the same problem we had before, where we were allowing people to have stackable credits. So, for example, the work that was done at Smith Bay, the stackable credits meant that the state covered 85% of the cost for that. So, you know, we may disagree on how much the state can afford, but to me, you know, that's more generous than we can be. And for example, one of the provisions of the bill that's the pre-approval process is so the state can get a little better handle on that. I am not changing, you know, we are not suggesting changing from a net profit system. We're still recognizing recovery of costs through net profits, as well as carry forward losses and GVR and per barrel credits. So there's still a lot of, the best way I can describe it is generosity, or opportunities going forward. Now, I will say that, you know, something like that is a lot more attractive to me and realistic because when you look at its proximity to existing infrastructure, you know, getting those barrels into taps is going to be a lot less costly. And if we use Point Thompson as an example and an experience, and if this were a 200,000 barrel find, you'd have a bigger pipeline than the Point Thompson 70,000 barrel one, and that was phenomenally expensive. So I can't see any practical way how you could build a 124-mile pipe to get oil into taps right now if it's $55 a barrel. And if the state is going to be sort of a co-investor by allowing these expenses to be deducted, I think we want to be as strategic as possible in the dollars that the state invests. Okay. I hope that sort of helps where we're coming from.
I just want to hear what you had to say.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher.
Well, I guess my first question would be how will the requirement of that the DNR reapprove the cost lead to net operating loss? How does that work?
I am the chair. So used to saying that. Representative Rauscher, you can be the chair, okay? Representative Rauscher, so a very good question, and we have contemplated this in great detail. Currently, there is a plan of development, a plan of production. Those are two, you know, documents that must be submitted to the DNR. However, those come much farther along in the process than we would like. And in the bill, what we do is empower DNR to draft regulations. And at this time, that seemed like the most appropriate thing because what will happen through the regulatory process is they'll go out for public comment and all of the stakeholders, those that are joining us here in the room today and the other industry folks, will have an opportunity to comment and make sure that whatever is adopted makes sense for the industry. And I think those folks are probably a little better suited than we are in making that determination and making it work. We were kind of going off some of the information. If you might remember one day Mr. Ruggiero talked about in some regimes he's worked in, you know, that there were these multiple sort of points of contact, if you will, with the governing regime, and they had to kind of come in and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and this is how much we're going to spend. And, you know, so long as our budgets are a bit constrained and we want to be able to offer some of the incentives, you know, that will be available through, you know, this bill if it should pass in that program, it seems giving them a little bit of oversight about that to make sure every dollar is spent in the most strategic way could be of real value to the state.
Through the chair. Thank you. So I guess what I'm still trying to get my head around is how this is supposed to look on the DNR side. How do we envision this happening? I'm just a little confused. I know this is not their position in the past to actually accept this role. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to understand how it actually looks to you, or whoever crafted it, both of you, since it's a CS bill, just how that looks. I'm just trying to get a better understanding of that.
And Representative Rauscher, we've talked to the DNR folks about this to sort of say, you know, how can you work this in? How can you have better oversight? They are interested in having better oversight because what happens is the state does not have any ability to sort of turn down the work once it's happened. So, you know, things could be done. For example, one example might be not sticking to a schedule. And, you know, for whatever reason, bad decision-making, poor management, your schedule slips, that delays you because of limited, you know, duration of the period where you can do work because of ice roads. You know, so now you've slipped and you've taken your work into the following calendar year. Well, if that was done because of poor management, the DNR might have something to say about that because, of course, you know, that's committing to the state to some additional, you know, support through our sort of co-investment, if you will. And I think, you know, from what we've learned from them, they would like to be a little bit better engaged beforehand because, you know, once the spending has already taken place and you don't have a mechanism to say, oh, that was irresponsible, that was poor management, then the state is just sort of on the hook for the expenses. And so it's just trying to recognize that perhaps there's a way to create a system that, you know, again, I just think, you know, let's spend every dollar in the most strategic way possible so that we do get more barrels into the pipeline. And the projects, you know, if they had their druthers, perhaps that, you know, they could prioritize projects that were more near term, for example, over something that's more like a 15-year away or 20-year away kind of development.
All right, well then, so I guess through the chair, would we be able to question the DNR before we move this bill?
I don't think we have anyone from DNR available at this time, but if that is something that's important to you, then, you know, I'd want to honor that request, Representative Roucher.
And through the chair, just the reason is I know we have a fiscal note from the DOR, but we don't really have one from the DNR, and I assume if they're going to actually take the lion's share, according to this, of the responsibility for what's going on, that that we understand their position on positions that they may have to hire, accounting or whatever is going to be involved, that they have an input here somewhere on the fiscal note, and whether, and then I think it's going to run side by side, if I'm not mistaken, with the NOR, so there'd be costs on both sides.
Representative Roucher, the DOR would be the recipient of the, you know, the taxes paid, but this regulatory regime would be under the responsibility of DNR. When we discuss this idea of going to, you know, draft the regulations, and I will say, really, what was convincing to me was because when the regulations go out for public comment, that all the industry folks would have an opportunity to participate. And I think one of the my biggest takeaways from working on this is that every company is a little bit different. The work they're doing is a little bit different. What, you know, how Alaska fits into their overall company portfolio is different based on what company you're addressing. And to have that process where each of those could really weigh in on the specifics of what could work for them seemed like there'd be a lot of value so that we could have something that could work for everyone. There was not discussion about needing additional staffing. However, I really appreciate that question, and maybe we could see if someone's available while we're continuing to do our work here today to get that question answered.
Okay. So, who has control over the allowable lease expenses? And I mean control now. I'm not talking about calculations or anything. Who has control? Is it the DOR or the DNR?
Representative Roucher, can you help me understand what you say by control? Because the very problem is that nobody has any control over them now.
Correct. And I mean underneath your underneath the CS.
It would be DNR.
The DNR has all the control now.
They would be able to, you know, through this regulatory process, create a system that would be standard, that, you know, everyone had to follow the same system. And it could be, you know, it sounded like from what Rich said, we talked this through with him, you know, as informal as these meetings where certain documentation is provided. You know, it sounded to me as he described it and in a follow-up meeting with him that he's had both that experience and something that's much more formalized. And again, you know, my hope is that, you know, the very people who are at the DNR doing this work on a daily basis in partnership with the industry folks would craft something that was sort of the, I always think of the Alaska solution, right? We need the thing that works for Alaska, not, you know, what worked in some other state. But hopefully we can learn from these other regimes and be able to, you know, be able to do the right thing.
So through the chair again, so would the taxpayer have to submit an annual lease expenditure estimate on January 1st of each year to get a pre-approval, or is this going to, how is this going to shape out here?
Representative Roucher, that has not been determined yet, because what the bill says is that they'll develop regulations, and, you know, the regulations.
So it's to the DNR to decide this?
Well, to develop the regulations, and then through the public comment and public process. And I think, you know, when we've passed any of these measures in the past, there's always been sort of a complex regulatory process that's followed, and the industry folks have been heavily involved in weighing in on what those regulations would look like.
And if the taxpayers are off on their estimates, is there going to be extra costs or something involved there?
The bill as written doesn't have any sort of punitive measure of any kind in it, and I don't really anticipate that. But I think what can be gained from it is if we, for example, you know, using that example that was described before about the poor management or, you know, just the bad sort of spending, it may help the DNR to identify what some of the problems are and then, you know, have the opportunity to figure out how to correct them.
And not to belabor this, but I can see some problems in an audit system.
Mm-hmm.
And I just see another branch being set up alongside a branch that exists, and there's going to be quite an expense going on here. That's all I'm trying to say here in this kind of questioning. I think it's kind of easy to say, well, there shouldn't be much, maybe a couple extra guys go out and look at a few permits or look at a few expenditures and look at a few NOLs or see what's moving forward. But once you start adding in all those other things, I think it gets very complicated and almost like starting a separate arm that does somewhat similar now, and I just see a big expense.
Okay, I appreciate that. And because we talked to the DNR and that was not, you know, when we sort of said, is this something you can do and, you know, how hard would it be to do? And their response was yes and not that hard. And so, you know, I apologize that we don't have a DNR person, but that's what our committee aide is off trying to do right now to get response to that. And so we'll absolutely try to get that question answered. But just to be clear, you know, the DOR is involved after the fact, right? So that's after the spending has taken place,
right?
And, you know, turning in, you know, your tax information. Mm-hmm. This is trying to get a better understanding beforehand so we can, you know, sort of not obligate ourselves, I guess, to, you know, the projects that don't have the most potential.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Can we have a brief at ease?
Yeah. Okay. 219. Representative Josephson had a couple comments.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess the things that I find things that I support certainly are a couple things that I wanted to add, and that is that when Senate Bill 21 passed, there was this belief of a 4% hard floor, and in fact, that didn't exist. And so I think because of this, the bills are coming back.
We need a bill for ghost extraction.
Ghost extraction.
Don't say anything to you.
Okay.
You are on the record. We are on the record, but unofficially on the record, right? Test 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
American freedom.
We're back on the record at 2:34. For any folks following along, we've had some technology issues with the Resources Committee room, so we've moved to the HES Committee room. So we're now in room 106, if anybody was wanting to come join us. And Representative Josephson was making some comments just before we had to break.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So just very broadly, I was asked when we left room 124 to come to room 106 for some reflections on the bill, and I guess the number of things come to mind. The first is a recollection of real astonishment that last year around this time
the legislature came to learn, and I remember sort of the press announcements about this in the, I would think, early February timeframe, that credits, particularly when stacked in a low price environment, could bring the taxable value beneath zero, and that was a source of real concern. And one of the things that came from those media accounts was some reflection on the fact that that was not really understood in Senate Bill 21. It may have been understood by some, but it was not something that had been vetted well by either chamber in 2013 when Senate Bill 21 passed. And some of that was remedied in in House Bill 247. But more directly, this question about DNR's involvement is an interesting one, in that there's been a lot of belief and reflection on the fact, and Mr. Ruggiero discussed this, that the public should be entitled to more information about the investments we've made. And one could assert that under this CS, those investments will no longer be cash investments, so what is the fuss and bother? But I still think that because there will be deductions taken against liability, and in fact there will be some net operating losses, the public is entitled to know that. And that, in turn, I think, connects itself to the issue of pre-approval. And I think that it warrants some of that. And I understand that there's real delegation here that's being made to the Department of Natural Resources, but I think that it's warranted, and I'll talk more globally about the CS if or when we come to that point. But I would say one thing, and that is that the operators, when they make a decision in the field to invest, are already having to meet internally with approval moving forward. And I don't mean this language to be patriarchal or patronizing, but I think that the public is entitled to know what the investments are and to have some share in understanding that through their elected officials. And I think that's particularly true when we see that there isn't ring fencing, and so a profitable field in one location could make the company unprofitable in toto because of another location. So I just wanted to make those comments.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think first and foremost, we need to ask ourselves if this proposal, this committee substitute, is in fact going to attract investment and make the kind of exploration development happen that's going to put more oil in the pipeline. When I look at the committee substitute and the financial piece, the fiscal note, it adds $190 million in expense. We're talking about fiscal year 18, and by fiscal year 20, it shows another $190 million worth of expense on the other side. Lost in the discussion, in my view, has been the state royalty share. And I think we need to look to DNR, and I would hope we can get the Department of Natural Resources in here to talk with us about this committee substitute before we move too far along down the road. But if you look at the 120,000 barrel a day prospect potential that we're looking at with Armstrong and Repsol, at a 1/6 royalty share, that's about 20,000 barrels a day for Alaska. 20,000 barrels a day, multiply that times about 50, that's about $1 million a day in royalty times 365 days a year. That's between $300 and $400 million a year in royalty off of that one discovery and that one potential. So I think what we need to do is not be so dismissive of the royalty share. We need to make sure that we're doing what we can to put oil in the pipeline, to attract investment, and to be the best we can be as far as our exercising our fiduciary responsibility to the favorable development of our resources. And to that end, I think DNR needs to be here. I think we need to talk to them, and I think we need to take a real hard look at if adding another couple hundred million a year in costs is going to attract the kind of investment that we need to realize our oil and gas potential in the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Birch. And we do have a couple of amendments, so we'll have another opportunity sort of for closing comments, but any sort of general comments before we go into Representative Rauscher's amendments? Oh, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd first like to observe that our DNR alleged liaison is here. Hello, Ed. Good to see you. I'd like to echo some of the sentiments already raised. Before I would be willing to become an 85% investor in anything, I'd really like to know the nature of that investment and the likelihood of it paying off in the near term, the likelihood of it paying off in the long term. And I don't feel that under the current system we have that assurance. In fact, I get the very strong impression that we do not have the degree of oversight in where we're putting our money. And what's more, if you subsidize a behavior to the tune of 85%, you will skew behavior. You will encourage behaviors which might not otherwise be economical and which may not be, from a rational investment standpoint, worthwhile in the absence of a very generous subsidy. So I am glad that we are going to be, well, I hope that through this bill we're able to gain that oversight from the Department of Natural Resources. And that's the only issue I think I need to speak to right now. Broadly, I support the bill. Personally, I believe it could be more aggressive. We didn't subsidize the development of the North Slope in the first place, did we? And yet, it worked out pretty well for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you. And Representative Parrish and I will have to talk, because I'm not exactly sure where we come up with 85%, unless it's the system currently in Cook Inlet, which due to the nature of HB 247, if it continues July the 1st, of course, that changes. It gets cut by 50%, and then July the 1st, 2018, it actually completely goes away. So I'll just point out that I don't think that we're actually at that level on the North Slope anywhere for our level of investment or what we would do. But at the same time, I think probably, and I want you to know my biggest concern before we get into these. Right now, these are simple numbers. Throughput in January was about 554,000 barrels a day. Throughput in February was about 553,000 barrels a day. Even with low prices, and last year with low prices, we've seen an increase in our throughput. I was absolutely amazed by last year that our throughput continued to rise and continued to rise and continued to rise. Those 2 months were both bigger than the previous 2 years. So the trend right now, of course, is an increased throughput, which Representative Birch mentioned, and I think is really important, is that we've had this increased throughput, which, of course, is good for the coffers of the state of Alaska, because we do well off of royalty. Royalty is a thing that we obviously felt that we needed, and we've always been able to collect, and the more throughput there is, the more oil there is for the state of Alaska. So one of the big issues, I think, and we've talked about, there's been a lot of talk about tax credits, and a couple of years ago when we were in that, or maybe last year, with about $648 million or something like that, I think the thing that we recognized is the real elephant in the room that we haven't talked about was, I believe, $411 million of that were tax credits in Cook Inlet. And what we tried to address previously was, since our take from Cook Inlet is nothing like the North Slope, we addressed the big elephant in the room, which were the Cook Inlet credits. And we did it in a transitional way so that companies could adjust. I think it hit some of them very hard, but just at the same time, there's a transitional period where they adjust. We voted on that provision, and none of that has taken place yet. We haven't even had an opportunity to engage that, and now we're discussing changing the tax regime. Again, before that even engages or gets fully engaged. Something else in another bill that we have presented that deals with production taxes, I was surprised to see a graph from the individual that wants to increase that to where next year we have about a $25 million deficit upside down in production tax versus what we pay out. But I can see where HB 247 the following year shows $110 million production revenue, production tax revenue. The year after that, it's $136 million production tax revenue. So I think some of the previous action that we took has us on the right track, and it would certainly appear from the data that the industry also feels we're on the right track because they're producing more. We're getting more to go down the line. My biggest fear is that if we, whatever we do, I think we'll be doing a disservice to ourselves and everybody else if we decrease throughput when we don't have to. I think throughput right now on the TAPS line is the key. Several people will disagree with that, but throughput is always is a huge, huge thing for us. So I just, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I have those concerns, particularly with not allowing what we've already made a decision on even get engaged before we make a change to the system. I think this system will work good. I took a little bit of a beating I saw in some blogs and things because people didn't think that what I had heard from the public was true, that more people were opposed from whom we heard from than supported this. But quite simply put, it's a matter of record. We heard from a few more people that were opposed than more that supported, and most of my email is that way too. But I take a look at it overall, the overall concept, and I don't want to lose the current push to get more oil down the line, and I certainly don't want to lose the current investment climate. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. And I think on those last two points, we're in total alignment that we, you know, want to remain an attractive place for investment and get more oil and to TAPS. A couple quick comments. This bill does nothing to Cook Inlet. So one of the reasons it doesn't do anything to Cook Inlet is for the very reasons you just mentioned, that House Bill 247, right, has recently done those. However, it does have the Cook Inlet Working Group, because if you'll recall in House Bill 247, we have sort of this, I'm not sure what the right way to describe it, but placeholder, if you will, rather than fake, dollar per barrel oil tax, because, right, there's not a lot of oil production, but that might change. And the timeline on that is 2022. So by putting in the working group now would give us the time to really be thoughtful about that and really look at, look at those kind of changes and kind of get ahead of things. Because one of the challenges, and we do this not just in oil taxes, I think, is sort of pulling the rug out from under people with, you know, frequent changes. And I think for us, as we discuss sort of how we could make these adjustments going forward, you know, making sure, and we listened to Rich, you know, that there had to be an opportunity for recovery of costs, you know, and so, you know, making sure going forward that that opportunity would be there was really important. So hope that, you know, sort of just gives a little bit of thought towards that. I did want to make one quick comment relative to Representative Birch's comment about the fiscal note, and just want to be careful sort of, you know, depending on what part of the fiscal note you're looking at. And so he picked the fiscal year 2020 and the 190, but, you know, if you notice in this budget impact of no cash repurchase for the net NOL credits earned after 1/1/18, you know, that's, you know, kind of these are where you see a lot of the change here is the fact that we will not be, you know, writing these checks. However, keep in mind that that's just being shifted to the, you know, revenue side of things when those people become producers and will have reduced revenue. So sort of, you know, the investment part on our, on the part of the state does not go away. It's just we become, we allow that investment to be realized on the other side of the equation. So just want to make sure to mention that. And so if you notice, for example, you know, really the only place where the state in its line number 3 here is going to stand to gain is just the minimum tax increase to 5% at prices of $50 and above. And so you can see, like, for fiscal year 2018, that's $20 million. So, you know, that number's been reduced from the original version of the bill by making the benchmark there the $50. Yes, Representative Burt.
Well, just to clarify, I'm looking at the yellow line here. It says total fiscal impact.
Mm-hmm.
If I go over to 2020, which is
mm-hmm.
2 years hence,
mm-hmm.
it says $190 million. Does
mm-hmm.
that mean it's $190 more million to be that the state takes?
So just
the yellow line.
Yeah, but the way these fiscal notes are written, mm-hmm. you have the blue line that's the total revenue impact.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the total budget impact.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see those two numbers add up, 60 plus 130. That's where you get the 190. So I'm just referencing that, you know, the substantial portion of it comes in this sort of second section of it. So we're looking at the lettered, you know, A through J. And so a big portion of that, you know, where we save money is by not writing the checks. So we won't be writing the checks. However, when they become producers, you know, it'll be reflected in reduced revenue to the state. As is the case with the big three right now, that as taxpayers generally use their losses in the same year that they were earned.
Well, am I interpreting, through the chair,
mm-hmm.
am I interpreting this correct when it says total fiscal impact, $190 million in fiscal year 2020, and then it climbs up to $260 million in 27? So I mean, it looks like it's kind of an upward trend there, and that's all additional revenue to the state over and above existing revenue, correct?
Yes and no. The revenue part of it is the top half of it, and that means that would be new money coming into the state. The bottom half of it is the budget impact of us not paying out money. So it's actually, it's like I say, it's just a little bit different in that we're not writing a check. We're saying carry forward your losses. Once you become a producer, that money will be deducted from your taxes. So the dollar amount shown here, you know, whenever those companies become producers, we'll see that dollar amount shown as a reduction in their tax liability to the state. So not new dollars coming in, but us not paying dollars out.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we have two amendments for consideration today, and Representative Rauscher, whichever one you'd like to address first.
At this time, I'd like to move Amendment M.3.
Okay, I will object for purposes of discussion, and we'll label Amendment M.3 Amendment Number 1. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First I'd like to just reiterate some of the things that I've heard. And representative from Anchorage has denoted the fact that we have seen some increase in oil. We've increase of activity on the North Slope, which has produced some finds. We've had an increase of exploration. We've had an increase of trust in the state of Alaska for our producers to trudge ahead, and in times when we're looking at $40 a barrel, when we're looking just to get it to the pipeline, we're looking at a lot of money here that it takes to actually for them to go out and explore, and they put their trust in us. The representative from the other Harper Center has explained a lot of the things that he sees that he's worried about, and that's losing that trust, that's losing that momentum, that's losing the volume of oil in the pipeline yourself. I heard you say that we have some things in common, more oil in the pipeline. And I believe that this bill, 111, won't necessarily do that for us. I don't see it as user friendly for some of the producers. So what I have done is I've submitted an amendment to it, since that's the CS that we're going to work under. And the things that I'd like to say about this amendment is that it deletes the lion's share of the bill. Okay, that's one thing I will say is it deletes the lion's share of the bill. There are a lot of good things in the bill. There are also, that I see, a lot of things that I don't think are that well received here, and they leave the sections that address the dry hole credits and the carry forward losses. The amendment leaves the dry hole credit section basically unchanged. then at recess to carry forward from 50% proposed in the CS version to 100%. And I know we've covered that. I'm not quite sure I agree with the math, but I know we've covered that. And I've never really seen the model or the explained out completely, but I'm looking at what you had actually passed out. But anyway, we heard from Mr. Ruggiero, who I believe is our consultant, for going forward on this project. And the words that he did use were, unless we allow for 100% of the development costs to be recovered, Alaska would be at the bottom of the list globally in these regards. And it would be irresponsible to allow that to happen. Now, the amendment also changes the uplift from 7 to 10%, extends the life to carry forward an uplift from 7 years to 10 years. This amendment leaves in place the rest of the current tax structure that is working and has resulted in a greater investment over the past, major new discoveries, and increased throughput in the pipeline. We only saw the slide presented by Mr. Ruggiero, and I didn't really see the math, so I fully understand, but that's the reason for the amendment, was to get a good handle on that math. Likewise, the chair mathematical explanation for 50% NOL carry forward and the 7% uplift equaling 100% return on loss is kind of confusing to me. So that's also another reason why I only came up with 80%. When I did the math, of course I did it longhand, and there's plenty of room for error maybe, but I do urge everyone's support on this amendment for House Bill, I mean the Senate, I mean the CS 111.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Any other comments from committee members? I just want to make one quick comment that it is about 85%, and that's what the left-hand column of the handout shows. That, you know, the reason we use that amount for the uplift is that is linked to the interest rate associated with delinquent taxes that either the state would pay if the taxpayer overpaid, or that we would charge if the taxpayer underpaid. So for consistency purposes on that, that's what we did that. And then also, as I had mentioned, some of the suggestions he also included when thinking about this would have, you know, said to do something with the GVR and per barrel credit. And so kind of, you know, trying to just put all three of those things together in terms of what kind of opportunities we're offering. You know, I guess it just, I have concerns about how many years, you know, these opportunities can be in place. So, you know, 7 years of carry forward, but then remember you become a producer, so now you've got all those accumulated losses you can use, and you additionally get the GVR provisions, which is the 20% reduction, and then there's also a $5 per barrel credit. So by the time you use the accumulated losses and take out the GVR provisions, it just erodes a lot of the value. So that's my concern and why I can't support this amendment. Any other comments about the amendment?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think my concerns are that that if we offered 100% carry forward deduction, that the net result would be less, would be more impactful to the state than current law. And then if we added, in addition, a dry hole credit and some uplift, particularly at 10%, it would just compound that problem. So I think, without looking at a fiscal note on the amendment as proposed, it would put the state in a more precarious position than it's in. And those are the concerns I'd have.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
I speak in support of the amendment. I think, as we heard from the consultant, Mr. Ruggiero, virtually every business in the oil and gas arena is entitled, in just about every regime, is entitled to recover their costs. And I think sets that out. I think it's reasonable, and I think would encourage adoption. Thank you,
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Typically, businesses recover their costs by making a profit off of their product. I think that's the way that it's been done for the oil industry for an awfully long time. If we want to provide them with a subsidy in the form of a write-off on their taxes, which we then give them a generous rate of return on 8% for 7 years, that's fine. However, if we make it a 100% of their loss, 100% carry forward with 10% interest, I would be inclined to start a company, drill a dry hole, and be very confident that in 7 years, I would have doubled my investment in the form of liabilities. I could then sell off my company to a larger one, which is turning a profit, transfer over nearly twice the value of my initial investment to them, and maybe make a tidy profit for myself. It's a recipe for disaster and for really perverse market incentives. We should not be interfering this intensively and setting us ourselves up for this level of failure. I do not support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Any other comments? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to say thank you very much to my colleague from the Chickaloon area for bringing this amendment forward, because I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's perhaps the question for me was how much we really tried to take this HB 111 on, or to see us for it and really fix it, or send it off on its way and have another run at it. But I think that what we've got before us, at least the attempt to amend it, makes me feel much better, at least if it does get moved out of committee, that we just didn't ignore entirely all the public testimony that we've had and all the concerns that's been brought forth. And frankly, I have to say we haven't had a chance to really dig into the bill, the new committee substitute, but I'm pleased to be able to support my colleague on this amendment.
Any other comments? Thank you, Representative Johnson. Okay, could you please call the roll?
Madam,
oh, did you want to, pardon me, closing, any closing comments? Sure, of course, I apologize.
I appreciate that, thank you very much. I just would like to answer a few things, that there are different moving parts, and that it's all not one big block, and I understand where representative from District 17 was going there, but I think each one affect different sections at different times to really get a full grasp of what we're saying there. And I don't know whether if you're not really excited about 100%, I think somewhere in between the 50%, you're leaving them short. That's my own opinion. I mean, when you fill out your taxes and you turn it into their internal revenue, if you have a cost incurred, they let you use that. At this point, I'm not sure they're letting them use their entire cost. And so basically, I'm not sure they'll be as apt to want to dig in, go forward, spend money. That's just my opinion. I appreciate your time hearing this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. With those closing comments, Ms. Slinghast, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Dunn?
No.
Representative
Birch?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Representative Talarico?
Yes.
No.
Representative Josephson?
No.
Representative Carr?
No. Thank you. So with a vote of 5 nay and 4 yay, Amendment Number 1 has failed to pass. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this time, I'd like to move Amendment N.4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, and we'll label Amendment N.4, Amendment Number 2. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In lieu of going through the entire prep that I gave before, I still believe that there is a lot of moving parts in 111. I don't believe that it really services the producers to make them want to hurry up and get in the game with us. I think that what we have done in the past sparked them on. I mean, we have proof. It's happening. And and we go ahead and change the game on them too severely, like it says in 111, in the many, many moving parts, I think we're trying to expect a little bit too much from our partners, and then in turn, we're also getting them a little leery on our actual, where we could be heading from year to year, and every year is another change, every year is another aspect, every year is another disappointment, but yet they keep working for us. I think it's very important that we do keep them as our partners, and government needs to work hand in hand and not so much against. So in this one, there is actually quite a little bit of a reduction. We just address a few things all together. In fact, you're not going to see much in this one. It basically, the amendment resets the carry forwards 50% proposed in the CS version to 100%. If you want, you go to 80% or 60 or something. But either way, I think it should be 100%. We heard from Rich Ruggiero that unless we allow for 100% of the development cost to be recovered, that Alaska would be at the bottom of the list globally. The amendment also changes the uplift from 7% to 10%, extends the life of the carry forwards uplift from 7 years to 10 years. We only saw that slide for a short time, so my math was as quick as I could do it, and I had what I had, and that's the reason for this amendment. Also, I just urge you for the support for this amendment. Hopefully, you know, I think when you start making big, broad, general changes like you're doing, you're inviting a lot of heartache in future agreements for our producers and us. Thank you. I support the amendment. I urge you all to do so.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Any other comments? Representative Birch.
I would speak in support of this amendment. You know, Alaska is an expensive place to do business, long lead times. I mean, we've seen with ConocoPhillips with you know, some of the permitting delays up there, even in a fairly well-established area. So I think the amendment's on track there. We need to have the opportunity to permit our oil and gas exploration concerns and opportunity to recover their costs. I think this is a good amendment and urges approval. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Any other comments? Okay, I just want to make one quick comment just so in the context we can be reminded that in terms of carrying forward losses, that's typically a feature of an income tax, and they are able to recover 100% of the carry forward losses on their corporate income tax. So that has not been removed. And then keep in mind that the production tax is a deduction, the corporate income tax, and then the corporate income tax is a deduction against the federal taxes. And so there are several places where these losses are recovered, and we have not made any adjustments there. And I think one of the sort of challenges of our severance tax in general is that it's part gross tax, it's part net profits tax, and it behaves in some ways like a corporate income tax. So it has sort of this strange combination of things that always, in my mind, don't work well together, but that's the system we have in place now. And so, again, trying to be mindful of not being overcommitted. From my point of view, what's happened over the last few years with the buildup, this accumulation of the hundreds of millions of dollars of credits that have been vetoed by the governor, you know, I don't think it works well for the state to have obligations we can't meet. And from my point of view, even if it's scaled back a little bit, but we always meet that obligation, that would be beneficial to the industry more than having something that potentially is supposed to be available and then is not available. And, of course, you know, we have the power of appropriation, but the governor, whoever that person is, will always have the ability to veto any line items in the budget. And so even if we wanted to offer things, if we didn't have alignment from, you know, the person who has that opportunity, then I think that puts the whole system at risk. And so for me, that's why I can't support this, because I don't want us to be overcommitted to something that puts us in a position where we have to react again. And, you know, the goal here has always been to provide more stability, and that's what I hope we can accomplish with this. So that's why I won't be able to support that, Representative Rauscher. Thank you. And did you have closing comments, Representative Rauscher?
Yes, thank you. To the chair. appreciate your comments. I appreciate everybody's comments. I think both these amendments are similar. They do take care of the cashable credits, which I think we all agreed on both sides of the argument. We needed to be relooked at and evaluated and then probably redone completely to where they're ineffective there. But anyway, what I see is you're saying that with what I've put here, we would have to revisit it again, okay, shortly. That's what Rogero said. That's what we've all said. We have to keep revisiting. That's what your 5,000 dots on the little graph showed, that everybody's always revisiting. Mm-hmm. And so to use that as an excuse when your paperwork has showed that there's constantly always revisiting, Rogero has said there's constantly always revisiting, it's a fact that, you know, nothing's perfect until you figure it all out. So just to use that as an excuse, and that seemed to be one of the main ones, that I would have a heartache with that problem. But I apologize for getting your statement wrong if I had misquoted it. But I did get that from what you had said. I do believe that this is a good amendment, and I believe that it's probably something, it's very tame. It's not something large scale. It's not something that everybody's going to have to analyze and figure out and react to and re-react to. And I think it's workable. I also, again, urge everybody to support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Ms. Tillinghast, could you please call the roll?
Representative Westlake?
No.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Burke?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Representative Tallarico?
Yes.
Representative Josephson? No. Representative Carr? No.
Thank you. So with a vote of 5 no and 4 yay, then amendment number 2 has failed to pass. We're going to take a brief at ease. Back and void the roll for amendment number 2. One member did not get to vote. And if we could ask Ms. Tillinghast to please call the roll again.
Yes.
Representative Wesley?
No.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Harris?
No.
Representative Burke?
Yes.
Enthusiastically, yes.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
No.
Representative Carr?
No. With a vote of 4 yay and 5 nay, Amendment 2 has failed to pass. Before we go into closing comments, Mr. Ed King, if you could please join us at the table and give us an update on the fiscal note related to the pre-approval process, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ed King, Special Assistant to Commissioner Natural Resources. And the question was regarding the fiscal note for House Bill 111. My apologies. When the committee substitute came out, I didn't recognize the implications on DNR, so we didn't get it prepared this weekend. We are working on that fiscal note as we speak, and it's going to take a little bit of time and effort to figure out exactly what it is that we're being asked to do and required to do, and some coordination. So we probably need a couple of days to get that done, if that's okay with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. King. And at this point, could you say whether you anticipate that any additional staffing would be necessary for completing that work?
Madam Chair, as I read the bill today, there is a requirement to do some things that are outside of the scope of what we currently do, which would require the expansion of our accounting section. So I do anticipate that it would be a positive fiscal note on our as far as expenditures to our department.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. King?
I have a question.
Representative Birch.
What's the you're talking about the impact on DNR. What's the impact on the oil and gas industry and the timing on when this is going to be requested, new information will be requested, presuming this was to move forward?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, it's typical that a regulations packet takes somewhere around a year for it to get implemented. So there would be a period of time where there might be a little bit of uncertainty, and that could drive differences in behavior. That's speculative. That's really a question for industry. However, it is a possibility.
Okay,
Representative Birch.
Yeah, I'm just keenly interested in that. I mean, obviously, we're looking at it maybe from your perspective, but it appears to me like there's some pretty significant impacts here, and I'd be interested in your assessment of that as a leaseholder and managing that relationship, if you will. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Birch. And Mr. King, you think it would take a couple of days to complete that work?
Madam Chair, we are working on it now. I do have our staff at the Division of Oil and Gas trying to figure out exactly what type of work that this would require, and making sure that the regulations would be written in a way and can be written in a way that doesn't impede the ability for the auditors at Revenue to then audit the tax returns after a pre-approval process happened through the Department of Natural Resources. So we just want to be a little bit careful. But I do anticipate that conversation is going to take at least through the rest of today, and we're going to try to get you a fiscal note as soon as we can.
Okay. I'm going to take a brief at ease. What I'm going to do is allow the Department of Natural Resources a little bit of time to work up at least by the end of the day some preliminary information on that provision of the bill, and we will hold for that. Representative Westlake had a question or comment.
Yes, and through the chair, thank you. One of the real heartburn issues we've had over here is our accounting, we're years behind as it is right now. So we're asking for an accounting, so I would presume it would probably be on a monthly scale, I'm not sure. I'd hate to set a precedent where we're doing exactly the same thing, where we've made a ruling here, and the state of Alaska, through no fault of industry, is years behind on this thing, and is there a way we can address that?
Through the chair, Representative Westlake, I'm not sure. It is a challenge that this would require an entirely different accounting process than we currently have in place, and that will take some time to implement. If there's a way that we can avoid overlap and duplication of effort by coordinating with Department of Revenue to meet the objectives and intents of this legislation, we'll definitely try to do that and expedite it as much as we can and look for efficiencies as much as we can. We're not interested in growing the size of our department unless it's absolutely necessary to meet the requirements in the legislation.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to recess to the call of the chair, awaiting some preliminary information, but it is our intent to move forward, but want to be respectful to this concern that committee members have raised, and so we'll be looking for something from you with a little more detail before the end of the day. My apologies to committee members, because when we didn't receive the DNR fiscal note on that, it didn't anticipate that being an issue there. So I really appreciate being able to work that through, because it's an important provision from my point of view in the bill. And so at this time, what we'll do is we will recess to the call of the chair, and we will have to track you down in your offices and let you know what's happening, as well as what location we'll be meeting in, because I'm not sure the status of our normal committee room and whether the sound issues have been resolved. So with that, we are recessed here at 3:20 p.m.